the Z-Man, the champion. He's held it as prestigiously, both of them have. I'm looking for the first guy that makes a mistake, the match is over. It's Michael Clifford.
All right, let's see what happens. Let's see who can make.
Tonight, the belt comes home, Daddy. Take it to the bank.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Greetings from Allentown is not taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 167 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, because I feel like I've been living as Phil Connors in Groundhog Day for the last 7 or 8 weeks now, it's only appropriate that I would go to a show that aired on February 2nd, Groundhog Day. I don't know how big of a deal that is outside of the United States. It's probably not a thing at all. But maybe it's just popularized because of the movie that came out now 27 years ago. This is WCW Worldwide from February 2nd, 1991. Of course, the changeover just started rebranding all the shows as WCW at that point. And that's how I kind of go with it. Because I did a WCW main event from December of 1990. And it was around that time, it was a couple of weeks before, that it was still being called NWA Main Event. So that's kind of the thing that I'm going on. This was taped on January 7th in Perry, Georgia. So there's a good lag of 3 to 4 weeks before it actually airs. Interesting because there's a lot, well, there's some notable things that happen on this show. We're going to see two title changes, and we're not to spoil it or anything. I don't think anybody's going to be particularly disappointed, at least with one of the title changes. But before I get into all that, why don't I get into my plugs? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And I do encourage you to check out the other great shows on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Too many of them for me to name. I should just write them down and read them off, but that'll probably take quite a long time. There is one thing that I am glad that I have been able to do in the past week. No, it is not getting the fuel out of my snowblower, because I still remain convinced, even as it is May 7th, as this show drops, that we might not be completely done with snow. I know we probably are, but I just don't feel like rolling it out and letting it run and taking all the gas out of it after I only used it, I think, 3 times the whole winter, which is good, because I was out of commission for much of it anyway. The weather here, finally, it started to warm up to about what the seasonal temperatures were, and it was in the 70s over the weekend, and I noticed that my grass, I could finally cut the grass with the lawnmower, which, you know, is a kind of decent exercise for me, because the front of my house is a hill, and it's very, very hard to mow. It's tough on the arms and legs. But as I'm mowing on Saturday, it was kind of a busy day for me. I notice one of my neighbors who's jogging, and she, you know, she goes around and then up into her house. And then about 3 minutes afterwards, a whole bunch of people pile into her house carrying cases of beer. And I think to myself, they have pretty much the same footprint that my house has. Now, I don't know how they're going to spread out in there, if they're going to abide by what's going on, or if they're going to wear masks. I don't know what the deal is. Instead, they pile out onto their back deck, because it is nice out, as I mentioned, and their back deck is not very big. Their yard, which is fenced in, is not very big as well, and none of them are wearing masks. And as every time I look over there, I'm thinking, we are so screwed going forward because everybody is just, you're not wearing the mask for yourself, you dumbasses. You're wearing the mask for vulnerable populations out there. The kid who, you know, recovered from leukemia, the 81-year-old woman, you know, people like that. It's not for yourself, you dumbasses. That's what I have to say about that. I was really pissed off, but at the end of the day, literally at the end of the day, I'm not just saying that as a phrase that Whitey overuses quite a bit. There was a drunken argument over at that house between 10 and 10:30. Didn't call the cops because, quite frankly, then the finger gets pointed at me, and I just don't want that kind of heat. Besides, I had other things going on. I had mentioned brewing beer a few weeks back, and at the three-week mark, what we have to do, my wife and I, is we're brewing a Kolsch. And when you homebrew a Kolsch, you're not going to get the style perfect. It's going to be perfectly fine beer, but it's very, very hard to homebrew that style. So we're kind of taking a shot at it. And you have to use a secondary fermenter. So we put the beer into a carboy, but you have to put it in a refrigerator for it to work properly because it has to be at a certain temperature, like 40 degrees or less. Now, in my downstairs fridge, I was preparing for this for a while by leaving a bunch of empty space for this carboy, but as I thought about it some more, knowing that it was going to be filled with 4.5 gallons of beer, whatever it is, and then the weight of the glass itself, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't put it on the cover for the crisper in there, because if the crisper, if that gives way, then the carboy crashes down, it breaks, the whole thing goes. So I think, okay, well, I'll take out the cover of the crisper and I'll be perfectly fine. The one thing I did not know is that is glass instead of plastic, and that it is literally more fragile than 1993 Brutus Beefcake's face, because it barely clipped my wife's knee, who was, you know, trying to help me, and the thing shattered into 30,000 pieces like it was hit with IRS's briefcase in the middle of the Manhattan Center, or by somebody's knees in a parasailing accident. You know, not to make light of it, but it took me a while to clean all of that up. But at least it made room for the carboy to be put in there. So that was, when it comes to, you know, do-it-yourself projects, it's not going particularly great. But I guess, you know, you can get a replacement part for a refrigerator like that. What I was much more excited about was I had ordered barbecue from a place called Joe's Kansas City. It used to be known as Oklahoma Joe's, but it's in Kansas City, Kansas. Yes, the other side of the border. I've been there. And it's the place you've seen on TV shows that's part of a gas station, but they've built themselves up pretty big because they've been on a lot of these TV shows for their barbecue, particularly something called the Z-Man Sandwich. Now, I got to let you know, that is not named after Tom Zenk. I looked into this personally, and none of the ingredients you could tie back to anything having to do with Tom Zenk, which is brisket, a slice of provolone, a little dollop of barbecue sauce, 2 onion rings on the top of it. It is just a fantastic sandwich. But the best part is, you order it, they ship it to you, and you think, well, it's not going to be as good as what you get in the restaurant. But you follow their instructions to the T, and then you feel so satisfied because I remember what it tasted like when I was there in September of 2014. I wolfed down 2 of those sandwiches in 7 minutes. This time I savored it a little bit more. And the best part is, because we got two pounds of it or whatever, the kit has room for eight sandwiches. My wife and I each ate 2 of the sandwiches. So now I'm going to be able to have it again coming this weekend. So I'm particularly happy with that. That, of course, is the Z-Man Sandwich from Joe's Kansas City. I can't recommend that highly enough because you'll feel good. And it's a 440-calorie sandwich, which sounds perfectly reasonable in my book. But then again, you know, maybe I haven't really thought about calorie counts of sandwiches, but a Whopper at Burger King, I think, is around that 800 calorie mark. I go out of my way to not look at calorie counts. That's why I'll never live in the state of New York, or especially in New York City, where you got calorie counts in restaurants and on menus. It's like I know what's healthy. I know things to stay away from. Maybe other people haven't educated themselves on it, but you know, I know that the Bloomin' Onion, when you go to Outback Steakhouse, is about 40,000 calories, and then I'm going to feel like shit when I'm done eating it. So anyway, Z-Man Sandwich, Joe's Kansas City, can't recommend it highly enough. So WCW Worldwide, it's just I haven't been able to go into the history of these shows in quite a while. I mean, I don't like to repeat myself all that much, but Worldwide as a show started October 8th, 1975, as Wide World Wrestling. So they had things a bit backward. Not to be confused with Wild World Wrestling, which was the Cat Stevens promotion in the early 70s. In 1991, Worldwide probably doesn't have the cachet that it did in the 80s, because I've done a lot of those shows, the Ronnie Garvin, Ric Flair title change from 87, and a bunch of other ones with that funky theme. Jimmy Valiant getting his hair cut by Pez Watley. All that sort of stuff happened on Worldwide. 91, the stuff still happens. You have title changes here, but eventually it's going to phase down to the Disney tapings, where you're taping Worldwide in February and it's going on the air in May. And how relevant can it possibly be? You just look at the announce team and the absolute revolving door of commentators on this show, just for the year 1991 alone. You think the WWF and how the announcers would rarely change. I mean, there was a period, actually, late in 1990 where you had Vince and Piper and Honky Tonk Man for a few weeks, and then Savage joins in after WrestleMania 7. So there was things were changing a little bit, but Vince and Jesse were on the A show from March of 88, and it was just them all the way through to August of 90. That's 2.5 years with, like, no changes in the commentary team. 1991, WCW, of course, is a very dysfunctional product. And here are the announced teams that you would see on Worldwide just in 1991 alone. Tony Schiavone and Dutch Mantel. Tony Schiavone and Kevin Sullivan. Tony Schiavone and Gordon Solie. I mean, you can notice that there's a pattern here. There was one, apparently, that Paulie Dangerously hosted by himself, which I got to get my hands on that one. Of course, stuff gets purged from YouTube much more frequently now, so who knows? And I don't have as much of a connection for WCW footage as I do for WWF. Tony and Magnum TA. Tony all by himself at one point later in the year. And that's just the ones that I was able to find from the listings on Worldwide on the history of WWE.com. I mean, who knows? There might have been Tony and PN News at some point. Tony and the TaylorMade Man. Oh, wait, that's 1992. He would have been Terrence Taylor at that point. So, yeah, Tony had to work with a variety of partners here. And I like Schiavone quite a bit. I feel I'm glad that he's back in the fold doing a podcast that I'll admit I have not really listened to that much over the past few months. I haven't really checked to see what he's been doing. I know it's a lot of live watch stuff. But if you're into live watch stuff, do check out GFA Live with me and my good pal, Keithy Langston, the voice of greetings from Allentown. We did this past Saturday, the episode dropped on the Intercontinental Title Tournament from 1990. We watched the entire thing, all five matches, an 8-man tournament. And it got pretty nutty at the end, but nobody has stepped forward to disprove the theory that the Ultimate Warrior was played by Judith Light at one time. And nobody has stood up and said, you're absolutely nuts, because it could have been Judith Light. I mean, we floated that out there amidst the other craziness that we had. So I don't know how I got on. Oh, yeah, Tony Schiavone does live watches now. So as I said, stuff would still happen on Worldwide, but not to the same frequency that it once did. But what's interesting to me about this show, other than the fact that it aired on February 2nd, and it was kind of something that, you know, just a happy coincidence, January 7th, things are very different than what they would be on February 2nd. The booker at the time of this taping, well, I don't know who it is, because Ole Anderson had been fired, and I probably the WCW committee that they would throw together every so often, because Ole was cast out for that whole Black Scorpion nonsense, and a lot of the other stuff wasn't going all that great either. And they're waiting for Dusty Rhodes to get out of the WWF. That doesn't happen until after the Royal Rumble. So Dusty's there by February 2nd, but it's interesting he's not there when all this was taped. There's another interesting thing about this show, but there was a certain point in watching this that I realized something cross-referencing with Cage Match and other results sites that I found particularly weird, but I'm going to save that for the point in which I realized it. I believe it comes up during the Steiner Brothers match against the Master Blasters. I mean, you want to talk about 1991 WCW. Where else could you go to get stuff like, well, you can get three-quarters of that match in, like, 1997, I guess. But, you know, poor Al Green, he was cast out and he just never had a chance. So on this show, we will see footage of Ric Flair winning the WCW World Heavyweight title. Yes, that is when they made the switch to kind of separate the belts from the NWA. Now, he's still the NWA World Champion, Ric Flair is, which is why he can bring the belt onto WWF television later on in the year. We get clips of that from the Meadowlands. Another sort of feature match, I guess, a name brand match anyway, the Freebirds. Unfortunately, this is the Garvin and Hayes version against Brian Pillman and Brad Armstrong. And a TV title rematch between the champion, the Z-Man, Tom Zenk, and Arn Anderson, who should always either be the TV champion or the number one contender for said title. But another reason why I'm here is for the announce team on this worldwide. I know I ran down about a half dozen of them from 91 alone. It's Tony Schiavone and Kevin Sullivan. And if you know that there's one thing that I love about Kevin Sullivan is that he and I, we pretty much talk the same language. We talk the same dialect. And what he, Jesse Ventura would often wear flashy, colorful things and doing superstars over the years. Kevin Sullivan's outfit, which I'll get to momentarily. Oh my goodness, that caught my attention because it was the YouTube thumbnail for this. So without any further ado, why don't I just get right into it. WCW Worldwide from February 2nd, 1991.
Flair with all he's got, but it doesn't seem to faze the champion. Flair giving it all he has, but see, shakes it off. Then Flair for the ride. He's got him off for the military press.
I'll go a little bit more in depth when I get to the Flair Sting footage from the Meadowlands, but that is from the cold open. It's just that everything looked very, very familiar for whatever reason. But anyway, we go to our hosts, which is Tony Schiavone and Kevin Sullivan, who, of course, is going to speak in the thickest Boston accent possible. And I thank him for that because it allows me to maybe cut loose a little bit more like I do on GFA Live, because I tell Keithy, don't worry about concealing your accent. I want you to towny this thing up as much as you possibly can. And Kevin Sullivan, being from Charlestown, Massachusetts, he does not disappoint with his outfit, which is a Boston Red Sox t-shirt, but it's the suspenders that he's wearing with the pants that just killed me. Anytime a guy is wearing suspenders with a t-shirt on, it's always going to make me laugh, whether it's Kevin Sullivan here or Cameron Fry in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Now, Sully, and I can call him Sully because, you know, we're bros from the Boston area. He hasn't wrestled since Capital Combat 90, so it's been a long time away from the ring. Maybe he was in like a minor promotion somewhere, but he's according to Cage Match, he's been out of the ring. He eventually, in 1991, he becomes One Man Gang's, I don't want to say, I guess it's manager, but sort of like his troll. Because, I don't know, but all, speaking of trolls, Kevin Sullivan also plays one of the Munchkin-type characters that accompany Oz to the ring, I think, at Super Brawl 1. So, anyway, we got the title match coming up with Flair and Sting, or at least the footage of it, and Arn Anderson versus Tom Zenk for the TV title. So, of course, I mean, you're going to be hearing a lot from Kevin Sullivan on this show. I'm going to warn you right now.
This is why they call it the greatest sport, wrestling. two of the greatest competitors. They're going after the gold today. I'm looking forward to one of the greatest matches on TV ever, Cody.
The Fabulous Freebirds against Brad Armstrong and Flying Brian. What a great tag team match right here this week.
Can't ask for anything better. The Freebirds, they're the masters of the tag team action.
And fans, we will have an up-close look at Ric Flair, the new world champion, and what happened at the Meadowlands.
The man that continues the tradition to the 90s, the greatest champion of all times, Ric.
I would usually come down on a broadcaster for saying the greatest of all times, the way that Kevin Sullivan did, but I'm going to give him a pass because he sounds a lot like me, and we all got to stick together. Now, I don't know about this Freebirds best tag team of the 80s because we're not talking about the same team that existed in world class. We're talking about Jimmy Garvin and Michael P. S. Hayes taking on Brian Pillman and Brad Armstrong, and apparently we've just dropped that Candyman stuff altogether, at least in describing it. So with it being 1991 era Freebirds, you know what that means.
Of all time!
I know it's not the greatest audio of Garvin going, yeah, 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 as he would to the camera every single time coming to the ring as a Freebird from, I'd say, the middle of 90 all the way through the middle of 92. I mean, every single freaking time. I can recall where the big boys play on that podcast. It would delight Parv to no end, and surely sent him into, well, I'm being sarcastic, of course, it sent him into a spiral, which some sort of tailspin. I don't know. I guess the right wing wasn't level with the left wing on that plane. So I want to go back to Brad Armstrong, because they're calling him the Candyman, which left scratching my head. Why? He would wear sort of these candy cane tights. Well, thankfully, they had dropped that at this point. And Armstrong, to his credit, said, I hated the tights, but I was able to give tons of candy to kids. And he loved being able to do that. I mean, you know, anybody who's doing that, I guess, is going to be popular. But shortly after this, he's going to become a character known as Fantasia, which would be a masked third Freebird character. And eventually, they would be afraid of Disney perhaps suing. I mean, they do protect their characters pretty well. I mean, think of how many freaking times Disney has gotten the copyright laws changed just so that they can hang on to Mickey Mouse. You know that that copyright was supposed to expire in 1978, and they've managed to get it basically extended into perpetuity? I mean, I'm really passionate about this because if I had become a lawyer, I definitely would have become a copyright lawyer because those issues really fascinate me. And there's a lot of lobbying, dirty stuff going on with that over the years, especially with Disney. So he becomes Bad Street, or more appropriately, Brad Street, which is a great, that is a great sort of, you know, hidden homage name to what he was. And he was very good in that character. I mean, the 91 Freebirds are no great shakes, but it allowed him to cut loose a little bit. And he was, Brad Armstrong said that he was not sure about being a heel, but putting him under a mask and letting him cut loose was probably the best thing. Now, as for Brian Pillman, naturally WCW had no freaking clue what to do with him at this point. Yeah, you'd throw him out there, he'd have a great match with Ric Flair once a year, and it would draw a decent rating as it would turn out on TBS or whatever channel, but we don't really want to push him as a single. He's too small, even though he's not that much smaller than, say, a Randy Savage at that point in terms of the weight that they're listed. I mean, Savage was pretty jacked at certain points in time. 91, less so. So the Freebirds, they're established as a team. They've teamed together for quite some time now. And Armstrong and Pillman had not at this point. That's the point that Sullivan's making.
Two great amateur wrestlers, two great professional wrestlers, Brad Armstrong and Brian Pillman, but they're going against the premier tag team of the last decade.
Sorry, man. I've watched World Class. I've seen Terry Gordy in there. That he is not Jimmy Garvin. We're not even getting the Jimmy Garvin that we saw in World Class in 83 and 84. If it was that guy, maybe you could get away with it. But this is like different Freebirds. This is like saying the Golden State Warriors of the current NBA season, because they were the most dominant team of the previous decade, that they should be feared. Even though they went into this COVID-19 hiatus with a record of 15-50, which was the worst in the NBA for various reasons why that ended up happening. But that's the analogy that I can come up with. And hey, congratulate me for making it 24 and a half minutes into the show before making an NBA reference, since that's pretty much all I watch outside of the one wrestling show each week. Hayes is stalling. At this point, he's not really a whole lot in the ring. It's a lot of shtick, that sort of stuff, a Freebird suck chant. I mean, he's able to successfully squeeze some heat out of it, but you have to wonder how much of it is current heat versus residual heat from years prior. Who really knows? Armstrong gets tossed out of the ring, but he gets right back in because he had landed on his feet, and a bit of a surprise to Hayes. A backdrop and corner mount punches, but Armstrong only goes to three for whatever reason. Pillman eventually gets in there. They hit a double back elbow, and each guy is able to tag. Hayes does tag out, so now it's Pillman and Garvin, who I'm noticing. And I've talked about the Jimmy Garvin Appreciation Society, where he would wear the little white trunks in the 80s. Here, he's wearing long, like, reddish, sort of like a burgundy tights, and he looks really fat. He's in a side headlock, and he's not looking in the greatest shape. I mean, he looks in pilot shape, like an airplane pilot, which coincidentally is what he would become. And he's close to making the tag, and in a very interesting and fun spot, Brian Pillman is kicking Michael Hayes' hand away as he's reaching out trying to make the tag. And then Hayes gets all pissed off, so he comes in the ring, and Pillman comes up. He head scissors takes over. God, what is the proper grammar for that? Anyway, he puts his legs on Hayes' head, takes him over, but takes over Garvin in the side headlock as well, as they now work the left arm. But when Pillman is running the ropes, he gets hit on the apron by Michael Hayes with a knee in the Bret Hart Memorial transition spot.
He's not fucking dead.
Must have got confused, because the entire babyface side of this match is deceased, along with all of Bret Hart's teammates from that famous Canadian Stampede 10-man tag from 1997 that I've never seen anybody happier in a wrestling environment than Brian Pillman was, soaking in the cheers of the crowd on that night in Calgary. As Pillman ends up on the outside, Hayes with a big left hand, you know, kind of sneaking down from the apron, and a chop. And when Pillman gets right back up to the apron, he actually does another Bret Hart spot, although Pillman would certainly make it his own, where he gets kneed by Garvin off and into the guardrail. And Bret would kind of hit the guardrail as hard as he could. Pillman would always sort of hit it with his throat, because he always had that thing in everybody's mind where, oh, you know, he's going after the throat, because he had so many throat surgeries over the years. So Pillman is our face in peril, but he is able to reverse a vertical suplex back in the ring, and we get the dual tags to Hayes and Brad Armstrong. And Brad, he's Armstrong's, he is in trunks, he's not in the tights, as I mentioned earlier. As the Freebirds end up colliding in the middle of the ring, Pillman slingshots back in, hits a clothesline, everything kind of breaks down, and in the fog of distraction, Brad Armstrong had gone up to the top, hit a crossbody on Jimmy Garvin, but as Pillman has the referee distracted, trying to lead him out of the ring, Hayes kicks Brad Armstrong, picks him up, and hits the DDT for the victory for the Freebirds. Really kind of a nothing match here. I mean, it just kind of makes me sad. Like, Brad Armstrong was a terrific talent by all means. They just never really found the right thing for him, except for, ironically, the under-the-mask heel gimmick that didn't last very long with the Freebirds, their opponents in this match. And I don't know how much I can what my maximum level of enjoyment of a Hayes-Garvin match is at this point. Probably going to need a little bit of a pick-me-up after that one.
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing first, from anywhere he darn well pleases, 321 pounds, Sid Vicious.
Rules the world.
I prayed to heaven for something to lift my spirits after watching that Freebirds match, and God gives me 1991 Sid Vicious in return. Oh, thank you, God. Oh, wow. My God is an awesome God, as Tim Tebow once famously sung. And Father Sid Vicious is taking on Dave Johnson, not the Orioles hurler from 1989 to 91 and current Orioles broadcaster. And you wonder, Father Sid, what the hell does that mean? Well, if you listen to GFA Live, Keithy and I theorized, you know, why is Sid so popular in the Northeast? And I kind of drew the connection. A lot of Roman Catholics, and we see Sid as some sort of messianic figure. And I was comparing him to something of a priest. And I thought to myself, what would it sound like if Sid Vicious, or Sid Justice for that matter, I mean, you know, after all, they're the same guy, and it is 1991 we're talking about here. What if Sid was reading the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians, which is like the first thing that comes to mind, because having gone to Catholic Mass as a child, you hear all the various things and you just sort of memorize it. Second letter of Paul to the Corinthians is something I feel like they ran out there a lot. It was sort of like the Disco Inferno versus Alex Wright of passages that would be read during the Catholic Mass. So Sid, if it's Sid reading it, which I guess wouldn't make him the priest, because usually it's just sort of a deacon or whoever that would be doing the second reading or something like that, would go like, this is 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 14 through chapter 5, verse 1. Sorry, they don't teach the Catholics the Bible quite as much. Brothers and sisters, because we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and will bring us with you into his presence. Yes, everything is for your sake, so that grace, as it extends to more and more people, may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So we do not lose heart, even though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for eternal weight of glory beyond all measure, because we look at not what can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. For we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. The word of the Lord. Kind of sounds more like an Ultimate Warrior promo than a Sid thing, I got to admit. Yes, Father Sid, the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians. He just attacks right away on Dave Johnson. And he follows it up with a homily. Oh, excuse me, it's an inset promo. I think I'll call it the first letter of Sid to the jobbers.
Just in case you haven't noticed, I have taken it on myself to start a new tradition for Sid Vicious, and that is his victims after the powerbomb will be stretchered out, because I rule the world.
Praise be to God, Father Sid. Of course, later in February, he would nearly kill Brian Pillman with a powerbomb in the War Games, in which Pillman kind of hit the ceiling and didn't really come down right either. Kind of leads into the end of the match, which is Elegante coming down, and somehow he has power of attorney to give up for the rest of the team. But hey, Sid was pretty dominant, so I'm not going to take much issue of it. He hits the powerbomb here on Dave Johnson, and that brings a less than merciful end to this match. I wanted more Sid. Like, why are the Freebirds allowed to go 9 minutes? And Sid, you know, this squash is over with really in a flash, like less than a minute and a half. But I do await word from Father Sid to see if there'll be a second collection this week.
They better get this kid a stretcher. He needs it.
Here's your winner, Sid Vicious.
Well, I guess no second collection this week, but I couldn't really make out what he was saying. Something about having no friends? Like, Sid, you have the Horseman, although maybe Flair secretly doesn't like you, but Dan Spivey, you're friendly with him going back in the skyscrapers, so I don't know. Maybe Sid is just hesitant to reach out to other people. Perhaps, you know, within his church, he could reach out and, you know, find people that he has a common bond with.
Okay, Kevin, now we're going to take a look at what happened recently in the Meadowlands, the situation between Ric Flair, the world champion now for the seventh time, and Sting.
What happened in the Meadowlands was really a basic situation of life. The belt came back where it belongs, the greatest champion of all time, Ric Flair, Tony.
Well, of course, that's your opinion, but of course, there is still Sting, one of the top athletes ever in world championship wrestling. We're going to take you back right now and take a look at this exclusive footage right here on Worldwide at what transpired just recently between Ric Flair and Sting.
Anytime WCW or the NWA before that with Crockett would try to break into the New York market, it would always be kind of an interesting show. Right before Starrcade 87, they did a War Games at the Nassau Coliseum. And there were other tries. MSG, that's a no-go because WWF had that on lock because things were just different in that time frame. Of course, now they seem more focused on the Barclays, which opens the door for Ring of Honor New Japan to run that show there last year. But the Meadowlands, it's a way, as anybody who attended WrestleMania 35 can attest, it's not like it's right next to New York City. You have to drive there. Because forget about taking public transit. There's still people trying to get home from WrestleMania 35, or so the legend goes. So 5,000 people showed up to this, which does not sound good because that is, you know, that's an arena that holds 20,000 for hockey. Problem was there was a snowstorm, which you could have predicted in January in New Jersey. In fact, just 4 years before that, in January of 1987, there was a blizzard so severe that the New Jersey Devils game that night, while it started about 2 hours late because the players couldn't get to the arena. New Jersey played Calgary in front of 334 people, and there's this club that the New Jersey Devils still honor for everybody who made it to that game. I always like going to Bruins games when there's snowstorms. Of course, I live so far out now that that's far less frequent than it used to be. So we go to the clip of Sting and Ric Flair, which was not the last match of the night. The final match was actually a steel cage, Arn Anderson and Barry Windham against Doom in a non-title match, which Butch Reed accidentally hit his partner. But we're going to see Doom a little bit later. A couple of other interesting items from that show. Number one thing would probably be WCW U.S. champion Lex Luger with Lawrence Taylor of the New York Giants defeated Curtis Hughes, Mr. Hughes, with Paul E. Dangerously in a football challenge match at 206. Both men wore football gear, and the goal was to knock the opponent over the top rope. Well, the Giants are on path to go to the Super Bowl against the Buffalo Bills, but they still haven't even played the divisional round but when that show is actually on. So anyway, to the Flair Sting match, which is what I should ostensibly be talking about. And as I said in the cold open looked very familiar. And the first thing we see is a backslide by Sting for a two count. Flair begs off, and we're literally getting all of the Ric Flair spots here, which seems very familiar and goes into the criticism of Flair of basically running the same match over and over again. I don't necessarily buy that, but I think the criticism is valid when you're talking about Flair versus Sting and Flair versus Luger. I think Flair had better matches with Luger than with Sting personally, but the Clash match with Sting, the reason why I think that gets remembered so fondly is because it was the first one. And then you go later than that, a lot, Flair and Sting, they would just run the same spots over and over again. Corner mount punches, Flair flip in the corner. Yes, he would do that in every match, not just with Sting. And when he runs on the apron, he ends up getting clotheslined to the floor. Outside, Flair is sent headfirst into the railing, at which point the camera cuts away to some fans in the crowd for an uncomfortably long period of time. Like, oh, apparently Flair must have had trouble getting the blade out or couldn't get the right slice on his forehead. And wouldn't you know that when it comes back to him, he's now bleeding. As Sting is kind of brutalizing him, almost like he's a heel here. And once again, the military press slam, although it's probably the same one that we saw in the cold open, but who really knows. And a cross-corner whip, setting up for the Stinger Splash, but that misses. So Flair follows up by going to the top rope, and you know what happens. He gets body slammed off it. It's the Ric Flair Greatest Hits album, and a clothesline by Sting gets a two count, and now he decides to go up top. But in going for a crossbody, he hits Flair and referee Nick Patrick, WCW's answer to Earl Hebner, with a crossbody. And for some reason, Sting, who gets criticized for being a dumb friend and too trusting, here he's just kind of the stereotypical dumb baby face who goes for pinfalls when he knows the referee has been rendered unconscious or incapacitated for a period of time. So there's no count, and we get an Irish whip, and the two guys hit head-to-head. And what happens is Sting falls back, and Flair falls forward, and Flair ends up landing on Sting for the pinfall, but Sting had his foot on the bottom rope, so the pin should not have counted, but... You book a champion to lose that way. I mean, that's how Bruno, I think, lost the title to superstar Billy Graham in 77, which led to Graham losing the title to Backlund with his foot on the rope in 78. So it's not like, you know, it's totally outrageous that you would do that sort of finish. It had been done before, but it's not like it had been overdone, I guess, especially since they are going through with the title change. It reminded me of a British Bulldogs Dream Team finish from before WrestleMania 2. I think it might have been the Saturday Night's Main Event from March of 86, where there's just a head-to-head collision, and Valentine happens to fall forward and get the pin, which goes into the WrestleMania 2 match, where it's a head-on collision, but it's Valentine hitting Dynamite, who's on the apron, and Davey Boy is able to kind of get a flash pin. So Ric Flair wins the world title, and they're going back to him, and they didn't have a lot of good options at this point, because if you want Sting to lose it to a heel, you weren't going to go to anybody else other than Ric Flair. You weren't going to go to Arn, you weren't going to go to Barry Windham, although Barry Windham probably the most sensible out of all of them, but the thing was, he still had that ridiculous haircut from pretending to be Sting at Halloween Havoc, so maybe rule that out. Or, of course, I'll float this, is Sid, but the problem with Sid, well, there are a lot of problems with Sid. Godspeed and all that. But the problem is that in the Northeast, he probably would have been cheered over Sting, and that was the exact problem that they always had with Sting, is they always wanted to cheer Ric Flair as well, and especially this New York, New Jersey crowd that was chanting, "We want Stan," at Bobby Eaton during his match. Eaton was actually teaming, I think, I don't know who he was teaming with. I lost my page on that one, but the crowd was certain, the crowd that showed up, if you're willing to drive through a snowstorm to go see WCW in 1991, you are truly a committed soul. They go back to Tony Schiavone and Kevin Sullivan, and Sully has kind of a twist on a saying that his future boss, Eric Bischoff, would popularize.
You know, a lot of people, after looking at the footage and who witnessed that world title situation, feel that maybe Sting could still be the world champion.
You know, Tony, controversy makes the world go round. Some people may actually like you, you know what I mean? That's controversial enough. Ric Flair, he has the belt, he is the world champion, and he'll remain the world champion, no matter how hard anybody knocks on that door.
No matter how hard anybody knocks on that door. I should remember, GFA Live is my accent show. I shouldn't be playing so much of it here. It's been a while since I've gone back to that old crutch of just talking about the wrestler's entrance music, like I am right now for Doom, because everybody talks about all the sax in the WWF themes, like Bam Bam coming to the ring to that saxophone theme, but this is Ron Simmons' theme, but it was also Doom's theme for the latter part of their run, because originally it was Her Strut by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, which I don't know if it was a copyright thing or if it's the fact that Woman wasn't with them for very long, and that was kind of what made the theme song make sense for them. But a lot of saxophone in there, and as you listen to it a little bit longer, it kind of sounds like porno music, and it like kind of devolves into that sort of thing. You almost I'm not going to go any further down the road. I'm just saying, a lot of horn in that one, as they're facing off against Scott Allen and Carl Robertson, who looks an awful lot like Creek. I don't know, he just kind of looks like him. Maybe filled out a little bit more, but just kind of like the same sort of pasty complexion. Now, Doom, this is nearing the end for them, but they are the tag team champions at this point. They break up at WrestleWar, and there is a build to that point. But what's interesting to me is you get WrestleWar later in February of 91. They break up. They have the feud. But if you flash forward to the New Japan, WCW New Japan Super Show in the end of March, Doom teams again on that show, which I think they did it with, like, Dissension, because I think that they already had that planned for the New Japan show, and they didn't want to split them up for that, for whatever reason, or maybe they insisted upon having Doom there. Who knows? So the feud between Reed and Ron Simmons lasts all the way to Super Brawl in May, where Ron Simmons emerges victorious, just as he did in all of the house show matches. So a pretty standard thing, pretty standard way to launch a babyface like Ron Simmons. And, you know, I dug him, and certainly a case where Jim Ross constantly talking about football planted that seed in my head and made him credible. But for now, they got Teddy Long, who replaced Woman somewhere along the line as the manager of Doom. And he gets the entire inset promo to himself, and he reminds me of something.
I'm out here to say one thing, that I am the greatest manager in professional wrestling. I also own the greatest tag team in professional wrestling. So no more styling, no more profiling for the Horsemen. It's going to be all over, because Doom's going to take you out.
I originally wrote in my notes, that feud's over, Teddy. Like, the Horsemen versus Doom, that ended back at Starrcade, but apparently it didn't. And I just completely forgot about it, because the timing in my mind was Flair wins back the world title, which means the feud with Doom is over at that point. He's on to other things, but he wasn't even in the Starrcade match, obviously, because he has to go and be Black Scorpion and screw up his hair in doing that. So apparently there's going to be a continuance of that for at least a little bit longer. As Reed starts out, does some power stuff on Robertson, i.e. Patrick. I'm probably going to end up calling him Patrick from Schitt's Creek more frequently here. And then just out of nowhere, he hits a freaking tombstone, which I don't understand that at all. But he pulls Robertson up from the pinfall. And I noticed that Ron Simmons is not being tagged in, as Reed is basically going through his entire arsenal. And it might be because I know that these guys are going to break up within a month, and I'm reading into it, but I'm also trying to put myself in 1991 shoes and look at this like, why is Simmons not being tagged into this match that early? Double underhook suplex by Reed, another two count, and Reed pulls the guy up. I mean, I like that spot, but it gets overdone when you use it too often, or if it's Dino Bravo doing it. Finally, Reed is going to tag out. Ron Simmons gets in there with a press slam, and for a second I thought that it was just going to allow Robertson to go over and make the tag to Scott Allen, but not quite yet, as an Irish whip and the DiBiase power slam by Ron Simmons, which I'm going to give a 6 out of 10, because Robertson jumped a little bit too much into it. It's almost like he was flipping over before Simmons could actually grab him. I prefer the slow, easy, deliberate version of it, or if you're going to do it in a more snap fashion, do it the way Buzz Sawyer would do, where it's like 12 to 6 or something to that effect, the way he would just sort of turn the guy over in sort of a tilt-a-whirl sort of way. So now Robertson is tossed over to tag his partner Scott Allen, at a double clothesline by Doom and an elbow off the second rope. And once again, Reed pulls the man up at 2 so he can hit the clothesline off the second rope, which is basically the Hart Foundation heart attack. But instead of running the ropes like Brett would do, Doom just comes off the second rope with a clothesline. So a nothing match. Maybe I'm just reading into certain things that Butch Reed is doing and not tagging in Ron Simmons. But I think that maybe they were purposely trying to plant those seeds. In fact, some matches were ending around this time where Reed would accidentally hit Simmons and it would cause Doom to lose in something like a non-title match. Even at that Meadowlands show, which Doom closed, that I talked about earlier. And the ending is a miscommunication spot and Simmons ends up eating the pen. So you're going to build that sympathy for Ron Simmons and make Butch Reed look like the bad guy in all of this.
Now Norwood tries to kick his longest ever on grass, 47 yards, 8 seconds left. At Adam Lingner will snap it. No good. Wide right.
I have to laugh when I hear that, because I just hear Scott Norwood trying his longest field goal on grass. Like, oh, I'm sorry, he smoked a bunch of weed before the game? Maybe that's why he missed it wide right. You're seeing multiple goalposts or something. Who knows? Buffalo, when they were going down for that field goal, they were, to my mind, a little too casual. And back in those days, kickers were not as automatic from long distances. So I don't blame Norwood as much. I mean, they should have pushed to try and get it at least inside of 40 yards, because it was asking a lot of him to kick that long of a field goal in that sort of spot. Of course, things would just get worse for the Bills. And I apologize to any Buffalo Bills fans who have traumatized by playing that audio. It did take me a while to find the Al Michaels call of it, which I had to find instead of the Jack Buck version. So up next, we have a title match, a TV title match, alphabet soup, sort of. We get A to Z in Daddy Arn Anderson. I don't know why I called him Daddy Arn, but it just kind of seems right, I guess. So double A against the Zed Man. So it's like classic rock, everything from Arn Anderson to Zink, comma, Tom. And the Z-Man, not the sandwich that I mentioned earlier, of course. And Arn looking to get back that television championship that he had for most of 1990. Tom Zenk captured the title on the December 29th edition of World Championship Wrestling, the Saturday show. And as Arn's coming to the ring, apparently another thing that I've blocked out of my mind, he's billed from Minnesota. It's like, I never thought of Arn Anderson as being from Minnesota, but that's because the Anderson family and kayfabe, so you're going to bill him from there instead of from Georgia. I don't know why that didn't stick in my brain, but yet I can remember stuff that happened in like the 1980s in sports at the drop of a hat. Tom Zenk, of course, is part of that Minneapolis Robbinsdale crew that are all born in the late 50s, Perfect and Darso, and I think the Road Warriors are a part of that as well. So it's the last battle of Minneapolis in Perry, Georgia. I gotta throw it to Sully on commentary to see if he's got anything to say about this.
This is some wicked patty, eh?
Hey, have you seen Sully?
I look for, first of all, a classic confrontation. Arn Anderson, former champion. The Z-Man, the champion. He's held it as prestigiously, both of them have. I'm looking for the first guy that makes a mistake, the match is over. It's not good.
All right, let's see what happens.
See, what you don't understand is we sometimes drop our R's, but sometimes we add in a few extra R's, like Arn Anderson or Rern Anderson or whatever it was that Sullivan said there. As we start out the bout, the headlock takeover by Arn, and Zenk counters with the head scissors, and Arn quickly gets out of it. This happens two times in a row, and Arn is complaining about hair pulls, which there's nothing that delights me quite as much as when a heel complains about hair pulling when his hair is clearly too short to actually pull, because Arn has it pretty close cropped at this point in time. As the Z-Man is holding the headlock as Arn tries to toss him off, like into the ropes, and tries to do that twice, but Zenk is able to hold on. But then the third time, Zenk hits a shoulder block and knocks Arn over, who wants to regroup, but quickly the Z-Man grabs an arm and hits a leg drop on the left arm. So he's doing some of Arn's offense to him, and Double A rolls out of the ring, and he calls time out. Of course, there's no timeouts in the world of professional wrestling. Just I'll just give it a 20-second timeout, like in basketball, you know, the where you signal to the shoulders. He gets a 20-second timeout. He's Arn Anderson. He's entitled to that. And Arn sends the Z-Man out of the ring once he gets back in, but Zenk lands on his feet, and he catches Arn's feet and then crotches him on the ring post in the corner. And back inside, he locks on a headlock again. I just wrote WTF. I mean, what is Zenk trying to accomplish here as he gets rolled over into a near fall four times in a row? So, okay, the pace is a little bit slow early on, and they criticize the Z-Man on commentary, Sullivan does, for setting such a slow pace. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because he's quicker than Arn Anderson. Just from a kayfabe perspective, you'd think he would want to have a faster paced match. That's why Tom Zenk confuses me sometimes. Like, he has this match, which is done entirely at Arn's speed. Now, I don't know if there's some sort of injury. Who knows, really? But it's like the Lakers playing the Celtics in the 80s. And you knew I was going to go to this at some point because that's what I've been watching this week. And the Lakers just playing a slow-down half-court game, which totally to the Celtics' benefit in the 1987 finals at various points. But when the Lakers would run, they would absolutely kill the Celtics. So, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense at all to me. As the Z-Man is sent into the ropes, is shot to the gut. It was either a forearm or a headbutt or something. And Arn tries to follow up with a knee drop, but that misses. And as he's grabbing his knee, Zenk takes advantage. He locks in a flash figure four, which kind of comes out of nowhere, but he did just miss a knee drop. And he's kind of close to the rope, so Arn eventually is able to drag himself over there. An Irish whip drop kick by Zenk gets a two count, inside cradle for two, and then an Irish whip is reversed, and the Z-Man ducks underneath and hits a cross body coming back. And it is quickly reversed, but the guys go flying into the ropes in such a way where Arn's feet end up on the top, on the second rope, and he ends up getting the pinfall that way. Even though the referee could see that they were awfully close to the ropes, you'd think that he would look for it, but it's funny how these things go. It's funny how you got Ric Flair regaining the world title, his opponent's foot was on the rope, and Arn regains the television title, and his feet are on the rope. So kind of both sides of things. But things are back to normal. The universe tends to unfold as it should, like the guy in Harold and Kumar said, and Arn Anderson is once again the television champion, except he's going to be hurt for a lot of this reign. He's not in War Games the end of February. Larry Zbysko has to take his place. So it is, if you're going to compare Arn Anderson TV title reigns, this isn't exactly the greatest one he would ever have. He eventually loses it to Bobby Eaton at Super Brawl, but he's just a transitional champion to some guy named Steve Austin that's coming in June, who's going to win the TV title almost right away. I think he went on to do something later on, but I don't have time for that right now.
On a dark flat land she rides, on a pony she named Wildfire, a whirlwind by her side.
One thing I'm particularly fascinated about with this COVID-19 shutdown is the way it's going to change people psychologically going forward. And this just goes beyond a greater tolerance of work at home, remote work, that sort of thing, which may well solve the problem of traffic in our major cities if people are staying off the roads and are working at home. So what the hell does that have to do with Wildfire, which I just played? Well, a Tommy Rich match is coming up next, and he's facing off against John Peterson. But I made a decision, and I think, I don't know if I was driving to a brewery. I probably was, because that's pretty much what I do on Saturday these days. And I had on the Yacht Rock channel, which SiriusXM has brilliantly replaced one of the baseball channels because it's not being used for anything. It threw Yacht Rock on XM channel 178. So that's good. And that song by Michael Martin Murphy, or Triple M as he's known in the business, it comes on quite frequently on that channel, and it's not particularly well-regarded for whatever reason. But as I'm thinking about it, Wildfire being the nickname for Tommy Rich, is like, is this song about Tommy Rich? So I thought maybe I should examine the lyrics. She comes down from Yellow Mountain, on a dark flat land she rides, on a pony she named Wildfire, with a whirlwind by her side. I'm wondering, does that have something to do with Tommy Rich's early career? Maybe with a lot of women? Something to that effect leads into the NWA title. Maybe that's a stretch. Who knows? Oh, they say she died one winter when there came a killing frost, and the pony she named Wildfire busted down its stall in a blizzard. He was lost. You could say that the blizzard is Buzz Sawyer, I guess, in the last battle of Atlanta. Kind of a turning point in his career, the culmination of that feud. By the dark of the moon I planted, but there came an early snow. Been a hoot owl howling outside my window about six nights in a row. She's coming for me, I know, and on Wildfire we're both going to go. Well, the hoot owl, I guess, might represent drug enforcement agents and referring to Tommy Rich's, you know, troubles with, you know, narcotics through the years. And all those things have been documented on other shows. On Wildfire, we're going to ride. We're going to leave sod busting behind. Ride these hard times right on out of our minds, riding Wildfire. I don't know. Does that represent York Foundation, which is where he's heading here in 1991? Or I could just be completely full of crap and just making up something in order to fill time here on the podcast. But one day I just decided to bring it back to the song, that I like the song for whatever reason. It's like I remember that day back in August of 2004 where I swear to God, I woke up and I said, oh my God, I think I like John Mayer now. After just detesting him for 2.5 years, I just completely gave up and said, I guess I'm fine with John Mayer, and that's how it's going to be going forward. Maybe it was the Chappelle Show skit that Mayer was in, because that was kind of funny. Peterson, John Peterson, is introduced 248 pounds from Seattle, Washington, and I thought that that was Greg Valentine for a second, because that's like the exact same specs that Valentine would be announced at. He might have been 249, the Hammer, but it's a little too close for comfort. So I think kayfabe hometown concatenated with your whatever your weight is announced, you should only be allowed one guy who weighs 248 pounds from Seattle, Washington. And that's got to be Greg Valentine. So he's going to either have to weigh like 245, you know, cut it down a little bit, or, you know, say he's from Yakima or Walla Walla, Washington, or some other funny town to, or at least a funny name to say. As they drop in Sullivan and Schiavone, the former world champion bit when talking about Tommy Rich, and that is really just kind of a curse upon him. It happened at such a young age for him that, yeah, he won it so young in his career, and they refer to him as that going forward. But honestly, after a while, it kind of makes him, I don't want to say an enhancement talent, but you get Tommy Rich in your promotion, and you can say, okay, well, I'm going to put so-and-so over him, and like, oh, well, he beat a former world champion, and just kind of use that sort of cachet. As I said, the York Foundation is months away for him. But he's mostly, at this point, just sort of a tag guy who loses most of his singles matches. So, kind of feeding into what I was just saying. But as a tag guy in six-man, you know, he is on the winning side much of the time as he's working the arm. And the issue that I have with Tommy Rich, other than being a product of the North and maybe not getting the whole Southern thing, is there really isn't a thing to him. I mean, Wildfire is just kind of, you know, oh, he fires up. Okay, great. But it's not like that's particularly unique to him. I mean, you say, tell me, what's the first thing you think of when you say Tommy Rich? And I'd probably be like answering, I'd say, you're asking me a question when you're the same person. You're just talking to yourself. Like, yes, that is what this podcast is. It's me talking to myself. Tommy Rich, guy who bleeds on magazines. Like, sum him up on five words. That's Tommy Rich. As he hits a back elbow off an Irish whip, so I should play the little ding as, you know, bringing back the back elbow. But then he misses on a drop kick, and Peterson gets it a few punches, but that only allows Rich to fire up. And he's just going Irish whip crazy. Another back elbow and the clothesline, and then a very awkward backdrop. I don't know if something seems very off with this match with John Peterson. And then the Thez press finishes, which, you know, just some weird stuff going on here. And I'm not just saying that because I have it out for Tommy Rich. I don't. It's just that his finisher is balls to the face. I mean, that let's call it for what it is. That is what a Luthez press effectively is.
Tremendous tag team match yet to come this week as the Master Blasters take on the Steiners.
I can't wait for this one. It's a main event anywhere in the country.
I'm going to take a wild guess that that's the first time that the words main event were used in reference to Kevin Nash, albeit indirectly, as the Master Blasters are taking on the Steiner Brothers. Now, the Master Blasters, in case you've forgotten, were Blade and Steel at this point. There was a different guy beforehand, but it doesn't really matter. I'm focused on the here and now. Blade is Al Green, not the singer, although he probably would have, you know, said to Kevin Nash, boom, let's stay together. But that wasn't going to happen. So he was mostly an enhancement talent, although he became Dog late in WCW. I don't really remember that. Of course, I don't commit anything to memory in WCW after about April of 1999, and especially the stupid stuff after the when they blew everything up and reboot in April of 2000. And Steel, of course, Diesel, Kevin Nash. Nash would soon... He would become the masked Dr. X for a little while, but then on shows he went back to being Master Blaster Steel, and then into the Oz character, which is rather infamous, which he was undefeated up through the Great American Bash, where he loses to Ron Simmons, so get a little bit more out of Ron Simmons there, and he's Oz for a little bit after. You have a funny tag team match where it's Oz and the Diamond Stud against two guys I can't remember, but it's in the early fall, I think. And then, of course, Kevin Nash becomes one of the patron saints of Greetings from Allentown, Vincent Vontavious Vegas III. I think that's his full name, or at least that's how I'm applying it. Earlier on, I was talking about learning something later in the show, and this is the exact point where it dawned on me, because I like to cross-reference results with various things, and what I learned about this show is this episode of Worldwide from February 2nd has four of the same six matches, or four out of the six matches on this show are also on the March 2nd edition of WCW Pro, so I should probably make a note of that. That I'm not going to be doing that edition of the Pro anytime. And if I do, I'm going to be going over the exact same matches for the most part that I'm doing on this one. Now, as for the Steiners, Scott had just challenged for the Ric Flair's WCW title at the Clash of Champions in January. So not very long before this. There's no mention of that on commentary, which is fine, I guess, because it is kind of a weird one-off where this tag guy is challenging Ric Flair, although they did that with Hawk on, I think it was Bunkhouse Stampede back in the day. As the Master Blasters attack early, all four men are in the ring. And if you're going to do a match with Kevin Nash involved, don't do a traditional tag with the Steiners. But it's particularly interesting how this works. Where Al Green, he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran who is calling himself Master Blaster Blade at this point, although he doesn't blade in this match. Scott hits a neck breaker because he put his head down and follows it up with a belly-to-belly. Meanwhile, Rick Steiner and Master Blaster... Why do I have to keep looking it up? Steel... Steel, Diesel, I keep wanting to call him Master Blaster Diesel, but they're outside of the ring going at it, kind of going a little bit 50-50 out there. Meanwhile, what the hell is his name again? Blade, he dominates. This is like how forgettable these dudes are. Like, give me a freaking break. Scott hits an overhead belly-to-belly and an Irish whip, and he hits a pretty good-looking Frankensteiner. So say this for Al Green, is he can take a Frankensteiner. Maybe not on the scale of, let's say, Mike Enos, who, you know, is the best ever at doing that. He's like Eddie Perez to Scott Steiner's Greg Maddux. And that's probably the last time you'll ever hear anybody compare Scott Steiner to Greg Maddux. Blade on the outside... Well, actually, no, it's not Blade. Blade is the one who got Frankensteinered. It is Steel on the outside. And yes, I keep having to look this up because I refuse to commit any knowledge about the Master Blasters to memory. I know I should be professional here and actually know the guys' names, but for crying out loud, I mean, why should I even care about any of this stuff? I mean, it's like an existential crisis I'm having right now. Anyway, that's how the match ends, is after Scott Frankensteinered Blade. Yes, and he picked up the three count. Now, with Nash and them on the outside, Rick gets back into the ring, and the Freebirds are in, and they're looking to hit dual DDTs, but they each get backdropped at the same time. So it goes back to what I was saying, the Freebirds being like the 2019-2020 Golden State Warriors. I'm not really taking them seriously as a threat. I don't care if they're going to win the United States Tag Team titles later this month in a negative title reign. I mean, that's how bad the Freebirds were. Their reign lasted minus 6 days. So if that tells you anything, and the Steiners eventually win that for, actually, it was the World Tag Team titles, now that I think about it. But, you know, why would I commit that to memory? Because it just doesn't matter. Like what Bill Murray said in Meatballs, right?
He shoots them into the ropes, and it's the Patton and Frankensteiner. Look at this. Right over, and it's all over. Or should I say, it's just starting.
You may be right. Scott Steiner gets the win for the Steiner brothers, and the Freebirds hit the ring. And from there, the Steiners took care of them. There you see, right from behind.
Well, he was looking right at him, Tony.
No, he wasn't.
Jimmy was looking right at him.
I guess these are the things that happen when you fired the last booker, but the one that you're going to bring in can't show up yet at the time of the taping. So you just run stuff like this, and you make your heels look, you know, pretty weak by comparison, although it is the Steiner brothers, and they were always presented very strongly. It's just a shame that Scott tears his bicep in the summer, and we don't get a feud between the Steiners and Zbyszko and Arn Anderson, the enforcers. Instead, we get Bill Kazmaier in Scott Steiner's stead, who is basically like Ted Arcidi, but without any of the charm whatsoever. And I'm not just saying that because of Arcidi's accent. Well, actually, I kind of am. So as we wrap up, we get a preview of next week's feature bout, which is Barry Windham against Ron Simmons, one half of Doom. So clearly, the Horseman versus Doom thing is not over.
You know, maybe Ron Simmons got this much over as the best member of Doom, and we all know how good Barry Windham is. It's going to be a physical contact, and I'm going to watch it myself.
Unfortunately, that would be it for Kevin Sullivan as a color commentator on Worldwide. I could see how people might have problems trying to understand what he was saying, as Gordon Sully would be brought in the following week. And speaking of that next show, this video is a little strange in that it runs about 44 minutes, so the normal time that one of these episodes would run. Now, I don't know if something got cut out, if there was a Flair promo. I suspect there might have been a Ric Flair promo somewhere that got cut out for reasons to get it posted online, or otherwise it would have been blocked. Because it actually goes into the following week's Worldwide, which starts out with a Michael Wall Street match, which just so happens to be the last match he would have in World Championship Wrestling for, I think it was 6 years or so, or at least like to 1996, so at least 5.5 years, something along those lines. And I thought about covering that, but I just don't have time for anything in the Rotunda family. And I'm not just saying that because he was IRS. I mean, quite frankly, that match would have gone a lot better if it had happened 6 or 7 years before, and if it was a castration match and he lost, because then we wouldn't have to put up with any of this Bray Wyatt bullshit over the last 6-7 years. So I really don't care. And that does it for the real episode that I'm covering, WCW Worldwide, February 2nd, Groundhog Day, 1991. Before I go into my usual podcast plugs, I am going to direct you to the Place to Be Nation Pop feed and the show Laugh-In Theater, hosted by Andy Atherton, because I am a guest this week. In fact, that show is dropping today, the same day that this show drops, and we are live watching the movie from 1985, The Goonies, and I'm actually staring at the DVD case right now, and we certainly had a blast watching through that movie. And I hope that I add to your enjoyment of that movie, because I believe it was my 427th watch of that movie. It is kind of approximate, I'd say. But I did watch it every day after school in fourth grade, I think it was. Problem was, it was the edited version, I think, taped off the Disney Channel. So there was some weird sort of edits that I go into, and other hopefully humorous observations that I make about the film. So do check that out. Laugh in Theater on the Place Be Nation pop feed. Now, on the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett, I know an episode coming up, he's got author Yaron Weitzman on there, and he's going to be discussing his book on the Philadelphia 76ers. Now, I know I have a abnormally large Philadelphia audience. Actually, do I? I don't know if I still do, actually. The book is called Tanking to the Top, The Philadelphia 76ers in the Most Audacious Process. And it's talking about how the Sixers were losing for draft position earlier, well, I was going to say this decade, but around starting 2011 up through about 2016 is when that wrapped up and led to Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, among others. Of course, they screwed up with Markelle Fultz, but I don't think anybody wants to hear me talk about that. The whole concept of tanking is most valuable in basketball, where one player can make such a huge difference just year over year. I mean, there have been guys who have been added to a team where they win 30 more games the year before, like Larry Bird or David Robinson. I mean, the list goes on and on. Even LeBron didn't make that much of a difference, but he brought Cleveland to respectability and then eventually to a championship. Of course, he had to leave first, but that's just topic for another time. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, they are reviewing a show that, well, I love Maple Leaf Wrestling. I mean, of course, when I say that, I mean like the 1984 version with Angelo Mosca on there, because I absolutely love his commentary, and I'll probably be going back to one of those again soon. I mean, I like to coincide those with when I go to Canada, but since I can't go there, well, you know, who knows. But their Maple Leaf Wrestling from October of 1988 has the unusual announce team of Sean Mooney, who is still very green at that point, only a few months in, and Jesse Ventura. And I got to hear this, because how Jesse might have given him the business. So do check that out, the Our Vantage Point podcast. There is exactly one comment on YouTube for this video, which is by Will Necklin, who says, "Great upload, thank you." And I can't fill a segment just based on that. I mean, that's just not going to work. So no YouTube comment theater this week. We'll probably have a GFA Live coming out over the weekend. I've tended to release those on Saturday, and we've taped them at various times. Obviously, it's not live and then immediately onto the feed. I do have to put the theme song in at the beginning and at the end, but it is taped live as we're doing. I mean, that's the whole screen share business. Now, I have not figured out what we're going to watch for that this week, which I'm probably going to start work on as this show is exporting, compressing, all the various little tricks that I do to bring this thing to you each week. So do check that out on this same feed. Likewise, I do not have a plan for next week's show, despite the notable fact that in my private queue that I have upcoming episodes for podcasts, once I move this episode off there, there will be 129 videos. Now, I don't know how many of those might have been deleted. I can see a few deleted videos. There are a few that are kind of close to episodes that I've done before, and there are a few that are three-parters, like there's a USWA one from 1990. Not sure I'm quite ready to dive into that, but I may pick something off that list. I may find something else. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe I should get back to doing World Class, because I've done exactly one episode of that in the entire run now, 160-something freaking episodes. I've now even lost account of that. And I did the other one from 1982, which is about as bad a time for World Class as you can think of, except for the fact that Michael Hayes was there. He was showing up, so I guess it wasn't all bad. So do stay tuned to that. I'll reveal on social media once I get this whole thing figured out. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you can kind of figure out my line of thought. like, you know, as I'm tweeting out pictures of stuff, like, oh, if I tweet out a screenshot that's clearly 1988 WWF, it's probably going to lean in that direction. But while you wait for next week's show or for the GFA Live that'll probably come out this weekend, do leave a review for Greetings from Allentown or even GFA Live. You can weigh in on that one as well. At any place that fine podcast reviews are accepted, such as iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called, there's all sorts of places that accept that sort of social proof, which is what I'm looking for in all of this. And I really appreciate everybody who writes the words social proof in the reviews. I definitely get a kick out of that. It makes me smile every single time, despite the fact that I stole it from the Bird's Eye View Baltimore Orioles podcast. But it really doesn't matter. It's all just sort of out there in the ether. I don't think the concept was invented by them. I'm just sort of reciting it because I listened to that podcast many, many times. Like, that's how I got into this game. Is I listened to podcasts for about 8 years and just constantly commuting to work, commuting from work. Of course, that's really not happening anymore. So that's why I really appreciate anybody who's listening to the show during this time, because you're probably not getting in your car. If you are getting in your car and you're driving somewhere, like let's say you're a first responder, you're a nurse, you're, you know, whatever, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for listening. And I got to say that I definitely appreciate it, because, you know, it's hard listening to podcasts when you're thrown out of your routine. It can be a little bit difficult to get everything in. I mean, I'm not exercising as much because I'm still using my knee as an excuse months later, even though I feel fine. I mean, I ran a mile last weekend. Well, not last weekend, the weekend before. But I had a mask on, and I felt like I was just breathing carbon dioxide the entire time. So maybe I should just figure out something with that. But again, I thank you so much for listening during this very, very, very troubled time. And do tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Victims of the power bomb will be stretchered out, because I rule the world.